You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Serum Archaeology Podcast, episode 77 for February 3rd, 2016. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk about theory in archaeology, specifically Serum Archaeology. Wait, don't press the stop button. This is an important topic for those of us that think all we do is dig holes and let Walmarts be built. It's more than that, and we talk about it on today's show. So, go blow off the dust from your textbooks about 1970s theory and their disco archaeology, because the Serum Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today are Sonia in Utah.
Hi.
Steven in Calgary.
Hello.
Doug in Scotland.
Hello.
And Bill in Arizona.
Good morning.
All right, so today on this snowy Reno day, woke up to about 4 inches this morning and it's still coming down, we're going to have a continuing discussion from the last episode, episode 76, and we'll link to that in the show notes, talking about the grand challenges in archaeology, because when the co-host here hit the stop button on the recording, they continued to talk about some stuff like that, and they talked about some theory and some other things, and we're going to get a little more heavy into the theory side of basically applications in CRM archaeology and things like that, and just see where that goes. So I'm going to kick it over to Steven, who is part of that discussion, and he's going to bring us into this discussion and hopefully keep everybody awake. Go ahead, Steven.
Thanks. We started up... Get more coffee.
Yeah.
We were talking about the grand challenges questions in the American antiquity, and Bill was making the point that he didn't think these questions were very useful, and I was arguing that they were from, as part of a theme where, you know, we can look at these larger questions that really aren't site specific, but we can look at our individual sites and assemblages and think about how those could contribute to these, you know, broader questions. And that's kind of where we left off the show, I think. And from there, once Chris Sims turned off the recording, we just kept talking about how, you know, these were larger theoretical issues and that we don't normally think in terms of theory. And we actually did talk a little bit about how theory was taught when we were in school and how we didn't find it very applicable within the CRM world, but that really all of methods are kind of framed by, you know, a theoretical perspective. So mm-hmm. even though we don't think that we're using theory when we're out there digging shovel tests and stuff like that, there is theoretical reasons for why we're using the methods that we're using, except it's so generationally old that a lot of times, you know, not only are we not thinking about the theoretical perspective, but we're not even aware that that's why we're doing certain things.
You know, do you think that's part of the reason? Is because when we're in school, we hear all the $5 SAT words, like processualism and stuff like that, and all the other isms out there. And we don't really think, once we get out into the real world, that I'm actually supporting this, you know, XYZ theory by digging this shovel test. And that we're just not using the same words for it when we get back out into the field. Do you think that's part of it?
Yeah, well, and I think that how we teach theory or how theory was taught when I was in school 20 years ago
mm-hmm.
Was, you know, you had your methods and you had your theory, but your theory was pretty high level theory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and not even just, you know, processualism, post-processualism, which does get into methodical approaches, but, you know, issues of structuralism, like the anthropological theory, right? And that there's a sort of disconnect in the way that it's taught, that we're not immediately seeing how to apply theory towards our methods.
I think one sort of issue is not so much that CRM does not do theory. Most reports, theory essentially is just making sense of what you found. So even when you're doing a lithic analysis, you know, you find a bunch of lithics, they do an analysis, they do a measurements, they do all this stuff, and you're like, oh, well, you know, this is, you know, archaic or paleo or something like that. And you're basing that, and that's an interpretation. That is theory. And so I think we're always, CRM's always doing it. I think one issue is that CRM and most commercial laws, most laws around the world dealing with the protection of archaeology are based in theories that are 40 years, 50 years old. And so when you go to school nowadays, you hear these, you know, what is theory and all these grand theories of what we think about what people did in the past. And then you get out into CRM and it doesn't quite jive. It doesn't translate. And that's just because a lot of our understanding of the past has moved on. But if you look at like most laws are you protect a site. So a site, and essentially 30, 40 years ago, most archaeological theory in landscapes gave up on the concept of a site. A site is a made up construct.
Absolutely.
People didn't just, you know, live in one small area that we call a site. They moved around. And so like a lot of landscape theory in academia now is talking about, well, where are these paths? When people go outside of their quote unquote site or their living area, when they went to go hunt or gather, stuff like that, that's part of a landscape. That's part of how people interacted with the landscape. And they leave behind a lot of finds. So typically, and this is, I think will probably qualify for most people in CRM, is when we find a single object, we put that down as an isolated find. And it's completely ignored. It's not protected by, I mean, unless you find the most amazing one single off artifact, it usually is not protected. And if it's important enough, it might be picked up. But those artifacts are actually had to be dropped by someone doing an activity. And so modern landscape theory says, well, that's a path, that's someone doing something that is part of the archaeological record. But in CRM, and this is true of pretty much every country, I can't think of a single country that doesn't do this. If you find one artifact by itself, it's not protected in any way, and it's only minimally recorded, if anything. And so most of our laws are basically saying, if you find a lot of artifacts in a location, that is something. And so I think I'll sort of bounce it back to you guys and see what you say on that. But I would say that most of our laws are written in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s sort of ideas that, you know, this is archaeology, this isn't. And that's where it was back then. And I think our theory has moved on.
Well, you know, I'll comment on that because, and this goes back to the first part of your comment, Doug, about defining a site. Defining a site in CRM, to me, it may have been rooted in some sort of theory early on, but now it seems like it's more of a business decision and not a theoretical one. Because, you know, we work out here in the Great Basin, the BLM in Nevada has decided that a site is two or more artifacts or features. So you could have two features, that's a site. Two artifacts is a site. Unless you've got like a broken bottle that's in 10 pieces, that's not a site. That's still an isolate because you can put that all back together again. So they've decided not to really have very many isolates because, I mean, quite honestly, you hardly ever find one artifact by itself. You'll often find a second one along with it. So they decided, like, again, not based on theory, I don't think, that they want to discuss these things that are smaller in number. Whereas the place I'm working now, up to 9 artifacts of a single class is still an isolate. So when you get up to 10 artifacts of a single class, which means like all flakes or something like that, that's a site. But if you have a flake and a piece of groundstone, that's also a site because it's two classes. So two or more classes or 10 or more in a single class makes a site. And that is purely a business decision because we've seen plenty of stuff out there where, you know, it's just a little projectile point and a couple pieces of flakes. And that is, I mean, that's clearly a site. I mean, somebody sat there, they did something with it and then left it there for some reason. Maybe it broke. I don't know. But, you know, that's probably a site from a cultural standpoint, from a theoretical standpoint. But from a managerial and a business standpoint, they've decided to just handle it a little bit differently. And, you know, building on that, we also talked about that a lot because there's a lot of sand dunes down there. And we've had the discussion amongst our crews that, you know, we've got this big lithic scatter and then a sand dune that's maybe 15, 20 meters wide with nothing on it. And then another lithic scatter in an adjacent deflated area next to that sand dune. There's a decent chance that sand dune covers what joins those two sites together. It just covers it all up. But from a management standpoint, we split those up because it doesn't fit their rules for what quote unquote makes a site. So I think this is why people end up thinking there is no theory in CRM, because a lot of our decisions are based on business. And maybe the theory comes in when we end up interpreting some of this stuff, but then we're interpreting it from a framework of what's a site and what's not a site. You know what I mean?
I would jump in and point out that a lot of this reasoning is actually played out in the literature. If you want like a historical overview of the site concept, I would look at Dunnell has an article, and unfortunately it's in one of those really expensive books, about the concept site. And he runs through like notions of the site and how site as a unit is treated throughout time. But on the managerial side, I think that a lot of times that's what it's become, because we realize that it's not a very good analytical concept. And the way that the laws are structured is you have to have something that's not a site. Because you have to be able to be like, you know, this is a go, this is a no-go, right? And our laws are actually about properties. And so we need to conceive of archaeological resources as like a property, as a like a unit, like a solid thing, like a house or a building or something like that. But if you think about the reasoning behind like why isn't one artifact a site, versus why are a lot of artifacts site? I think it was Joseph Tainter actually wrote something 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago, that deals with, it actually walks through the reasoning of why one thing isn't a site. And, you know, again, in the modern conception of landscape within archaeology, that doesn't necessarily work. But it's from a, you know, we need to draw circles around things and encapsulate them for managerial reasons.
Mm-hmm.
There is reason behind it. And that's kind of the theoretical approach that drives those methods that we all do. And you know, so you're sitting there and you're talking about like, well, we don't really have theory because we're just doing this and it's strictly managerial. Well, there is a theory that drives that managerial, those managerial decisions. And
we hope.
Largely, we're not aware of them.
Yeah,
and I think part of that is because it's almost because of the way that we advance within CRM, you know, through mentoring.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you join a company or an agency or whatever, and you learn those methods, and then you just keep using those methods, and you're not necessarily aware of why they decided to use these methods, because, you know, they don't really talk about that. It's like, here's how we do it here, and you go and you do that, and it reminds me of the old old joke about like my wife used to, whenever she cooks a ham, she cuts it in half, and when I asked her why she does it, you know, it's because her mom did it. And when we went and asked her why she does it, it's because her mom did it. And then finally we went and asked grandma why she cuts her ham in half. And it's because her oven was too small.
Right.
You know, I've heard that before. That's exactly the sort of thing that's going on, is that, you know, we do it this way and we've always done it this way. And there were reasons why we were doing it this way. But because we take a theoretical approach, we, you know, it's like, well, we just do this because it's a just so sort of set up for method, when really there are, it is shaped by theory, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Doug, you wanted to jump in with a little bit of history on this.
Yeah, well, I think if you're looking at original laws and stuff, like I do think it is really tied to what was the theory at the time. So if you go back to, you know, the Antiquary Act in America, beginning of the century, UK did a very similar one around that time as well. And the very first protection laws about archaeology or heritage were not even sites. It was just important stuff. So it was like Stonehenge, Mesa Verde, all these different things that were really big buildings. And when they originally wrote those laws, they didn't really write them about archaeology sites. They wrote them about buildings and monuments that you could see. I mean, a lot of them actually say monuments in them, not archaeology. And then we fast forward to the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and even to the 90s, where different countries, so most countries 100 years ago put out similar laws. Egypt has them, Greece has them. You know, all the countries around the world basically said, you know, very important monuments, it becomes part of the state or the state will protect it. And everything else got bulldozed. And actually, even in through most of the 70s and 80s in the UK, a lot of stuff, there wasn't sort of the second generation protection laws. A lot of archaeology got bulldozed over. And then you get the second generation was saying, whoa, hold on a second. Archaeology is not just about the big, pretty things. It's actually about finding out about people. And it's about finding out, you know, what they are doing and past people and not just, you know, gold and Indiana Jones. And so we got the second generation of laws. And that's you know, your Section 106, all that stuff. And that was rooted at the time when people thought that, you know, archaeology was still site-based and it was still that. And now I think we're kind of heading into the third generation, which I know you said for a managerial point of view, and this is a managerial nightmare, but it's actually happening, is we're actually looking at landscapes. So in the UK, they're denying a lot of building permits to wind farms because they disrupt the view of the landscape and what, especially at like sites. So if they disrupt the view you would see from a stone circle, I mean, you're getting some of this as well. Tom King talks about it a lot, though it tends to have not stopped anything, is, you know, sacred lands in the America Southwest with Native American groups that are still there, they don't want development because it ruins the, you know, the cultural landscape. And of course, it hasn't been too successful in the United States. But I think you're looking at the third sort of wave, which is going to be that, you know, archaeology is actually kind of everywhere. And you have to deal with that. And that's not to say that you can't dig. And I think that's going to change, you know, we were talking about no-go areas, how our laws are built around no-go areas. But I think we're really starting to look and see a change. And if the laws change, then I think you're going to see a lot of CRM archaeologists start doing a lot more cultural resource management and a little less archaeology, because it'll be a little less about digging up. It'll be more of what Tom King talks about, less digging up and more about what the culture is and what the area is, and a lot more broad in our remit of what we do.
Well, there definitely needs to be a change in thought. You know, what, like we talked about at the beginning here, we're still thinking and sort of operating in a way that was designed 40 years ago, and the world just isn't or more, and the world just isn't like that anymore. This is a good spot to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll pick this discussion back up again.
In CRM, a weekly podcast, asks CRM professionals 8 simple questions. The first questions establish education, location, and experience. The last questions are a reflection of that experience, and the answers will surprise you. Check out the show on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/profiles. On that page, you can also request to be interviewed for the show. It only takes 20 minutes and you don't need any special equipment. Let's get back to the show.
Okay, we're back. And before the show and just during our break just there, we've been talking to Sonia, and she was mentioning how she's a little more on the applied side of this whole thing, and has some thoughts about that. So, Sonia, why don't you talk about the applied section of this theory and what that means to you?
Sure. As field archaeologists, we do, as you guys mentioned, frequently forget that we are founded in theory. So theory has value to applied archaeology. There's no doubt about that. The problem that I've had with theory is that some of it is, especially when we're talking about grand challenges in archaeology, some of it's way over the top for data recovery on a single archaic archaeological site in the middle of the West Desert of Utah. You know what I mean? It feels to field archaeologists sometimes that that theory is just we're not making that much of an impact, or we're not addressing a research question applicable to a theoretical background. I've got to admit, theory was never my strong suit. That doesn't mean that I don't use it. I mean, I tend to mix processual archaeology with behavioral archaeology and cultural ecology. But if you think about it, a lot of these things that I just mentioned are actually founded in scientific method focused on the material culture, what we're seeing in the ground, rather than what we see in ethnographic studies. So I tend to look more at the statistics and make inferences based on what I see there. One of the concerns with post-processual archaeology that I had was some of the integration of thoughts and feelings and attitudes of people. People do things unpredictably. We can't always predict that. I get that. But additionally, there are habits that people tend to have when they lay their material culture down. We tend to, if you look at our own trash, we tend to eat the same or similar things on a regular basis. We're throwing away the same brands of things. It speaks to general habit, or preference of people. So, you know, I'm more of an applied archaeologist, but I do integrate theory into my background, but I don't rely on it so heavily, or I don't feel like I do. It's just not as big a focus, even though everything we do is bounded in that.
Right. And I think some of this from a, you know, let's bring this back to CRM archaeology in particular, not just archaeology as a whole, because you really do have to look at it like that, because one of the things Steven said in the last podcast was what he was talking about was how, you know, often we're data collectors, and that's how some people see us as data collectors, as CRM archaeologists. And we kind of are. I mean, we're on the front lines of archaeology, and we are collecting the data, and 99% of the time we're going to be the last ones to ever see that site, especially if it's going to get destroyed. You know, we have to collect the data in a way. Now that data collection and what we choose to collect is obviously grounded in some sort of theory for the area that we're working in. But after that, you know, our job specifically, when I say job, I don't mean it like in air quotes, our actual job is to sometimes just say, you know, what did we find, and where is it? I mean, that's what the budget is written for, is for us to say what's there. And how do we deal with it? Okay. And we don't often have time to even get into some deep theories on what does this all mean and where is that all going. Hopefully we can do that later on when we change our, when we take off our CRM archaeology hat and put on our scientific archaeology hat and say at a conference, we can start, going to giving a paper or a poster on what we think it all means. Then we get into some theory and stuff like that. But on the front lines of archaeology, I just don't, you know, there's obviously theory there on why we're doing and collecting, but it really is more data collection, I think. So, Stephen.
Yeah, I'm going to have to kind of disagree with you a little bit on that.
I expected that.
Yeah, but it's fun. Part of that is that, you know, to tie it into CRM, what these, you know, to go back to the grand challenges, what those questions are, like the larger themes that you can fit your data within. But, you know, and I think that, you know, on a mechanical term, on an applied level, a lot like if you've ever had to do like a National Parks Service style historic context, where you identify the properties, You identify which themes those properties fit within or not. And, you know, that's part of the evaluation process. And I haven't seen too many of those getting done, but the Park Service does these all the time, especially if they're dealing with like national historic landmarks or landmarks, NHL, hockey league. But, you know, the point is that, you know, we have these larger theoretical questions that, you know, or that we need to address, and where these grand challenges come in, and where I used Sarah Hare's expression disco archaeology is that a lot of those research questions are based on like 1970s theory, and there are newer academic theoretical modes that, you know, we could work with. But we need to know what the big questions are. We need to know what the data apply, the data that they need to address those issues are. And part of the problem is because we conceive of our data collection as atheoretical, we might not be collecting and organizing our data in an applicable way towards these larger questions. That because our mental questions are almost strictly cultural, historical, particularly if we're dealing with pre-contact stuff, that you know, we find the diagnostics, we lump them into phases, you know, we count our rocks in a certain way, that all these methods, these are still methodical in that, you know, we set up the way that we do these to answer certain types of questions. And if what, you know, the important questions are different than what we assumed they were 40 years ago, we might not be collecting data in the correct fashion.
Yeah, I could see that.
You know, because we're taking as, you know, our data is just so that it doesn't matter what questions you're going to ask, the way we collect data, the types of data that we're collecting are going to be appropriate. And that's, That's a big step. That's a real big jump, and I don't know that that's correct. And I'm kind of worried that we've spent the past 30 years collecting data that's not really going to be useful. You know, we like to pretend that we're out there collecting data, and then someday somebody's going to come by and do a giant synthesis of all this data and come up with something cool. But we're not refining our methods based off of what we already know. We're just you know, a giant combine out there harvesting up the data in a certain way.
That's a good point. I think about that a lot when I'm on an archaeological site recording it. I think am I recording this in a, to use a, I can't think of a better term, but almost in a generic enough way that I'm not influencing how I'm collecting it. You know what I mean? Am I collecting enough information that somebody could answer questions that I haven't even conceived of or nobody has yet? And you're right. I don't think we always are. But I think there are ways to do that, to collect data in a more generic sense. You know what I mean? And maybe there are things that we're missing, but I don't know.
Well, and I think that, you know, part of it is to play in your field a little bit, the fact that we're dealing more with digital data, and we have to think about how data are organized, whether it's through GIS or your tablets, or that it's a little less qualitative in nature or unstructured, and it's forcing us as an industry, I think, to consider how we're using data, what we're collecting as far as data, and how it connects together. I think it's forcing us to think about data a little more seriously.
Okay. Bill, we've been talking a lot in the background about this. What are your thoughts on all this? I know you disagree with a lot of what I had to say at the beginning.
Well, no, I mean, you had what you had to say was right, but what we always need to remember is those laws created that guided at least most of the cultural resources in the United States were built in the 1960s when processual archaeology was, you know, in vogue. So at the time, that was a huge shift from the culture area, which, you know, you, basically what I hear is that you're afraid of us collecting data the same way they did when they were trying to develop those culture areas or culture histories back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, where it was just, you know, dig up a bunch of stuff and then what came before this and what came before that and who's, you know, how far across the landscape is this kind of stuff distributed? And, it, you know, what culture area does this represent throughout time? And so for decades, we spent a lot of time doing sites based on that. And you see these, you know, monographs with tons of pictures. They're talking about the distribution of Hopewell ceramics or, you know, obsidian projectile points across X amount of area during a certain time period. And, you know, Binford and those guys were saying, we got to go beyond that. So I'm not saying that I'm a total fan of the processual bent necessarily. However, when we created our laws, the whole idea was, you know, the data potential behind D is to understand more about the behavior of the past or what was going on at a certain place in the past. So if you look at the reports that came out in the 30s from those Depression era digs, and then you look at some of the stuff we've done in the 60s and 70s and since then, you know, it's a marked difference. Beside rather than just describing ceramic sherds and their decorations and they're distributed over this and they're similar to that site and they're from this time period, we've moved on to, you know, where those ceramics have meaning and maybe the symbolism on them means something, and people started thinking about you know, completely different things. With this new landscape bent, you can, that Doug was talking about, you can definitely see very clearly postmodern ideas of, you know, endless sites, endless archaeology doesn't end in time. It doesn't have a boundary by site. It's part of a landscape, just like your culture continues throughout time. And it's really more of the view of what Native people and Native Americans have been telling us for the longest time. And now you're starting to see these things with TCPs and landscapes. Well, they're not really bounded entities. Their meaning doesn't begin or end with a certain period of time. That's strongly postmodern thought. Their stuff that's coming out of the 80s and 90s is now influencing the laws that we've got. So those theories, like, we don't actually write in our report section 5, theoretical background, you know, and then start saying Binford said this, and this is why section 106 matters. And then, you know, these TCPs are created on the concept created by, you know, someone else. You know, we don't write down those specific scholars and go into the high level, but it's like in the back of our head. And what I really hate to admit is those classes on anthro theory actually end up coming out in my writing. So when you end up reading horrible, ridiculous, you know, Marxist thought, and then magically I'm writing about some working community and then labor and, you know, capitalism, that's clearly coming out in my writing, the way that I'm interpreting these, you know, workers' camps or minority neighborhoods or something like that. You can clearly see that this stuff is coming right out, but I'm not writing down specifically. Yeah, and thank you, Graham C., for telling me all about the subaltern people. You know, I want to give a shout out and an acknowledgement to my teacher who told me all about theory, and I learned about this article and that article. It's just stated, and then the article that I'm quoting in my description or my interpretations, you can look back through theirs and see in their comments where they've cited certain scholars along that bent. And if you looked at that next article, you could trace it all the way back until you finally got to that one article by, you know, Eric Wolf talking about capitalism and the world systems. But we don't actually do that. And you mentioned something about our budgets don't necessarily have time to go into these deeper questions. Part of the proving that something has data potential is drawing upon those theoretical concepts, like at this point in time, the landscape was this way different, and bison had moved on by that point. However, in the people, we still see that they're using this projectile point and that thing, which we know is associated with big game hunters. This site is important because it can give us information on big game hunting in the late Archaic in Montana. And that's like all we write. However, that's just straight up Binfordian theory.
Right. You know, I think I should have restructured this podcast or structured it a little differently, because I agree with you, Bill. That is where in the report you do have a place where you can start, you know, at least lining out your ideas. Whether or not anybody's ever going to read that in your gray literature is another question entirely. However, I think I should have structured this to field work and then report writing and then possibly post-report writing. Like, what do you do after that? Papers, conferences, things like that. Because in field work, I think, just to bring this back to what I was talking about earlier, in field work, I think we need to record a little more atheoretically, because I think we're doing a disservice and we're putting in too much of a bias into a site. If we go into a lithic scatter or, you know, some sort of habitation site with certain theories in our head, then, you know, I feel like we could record that differently, and future researchers, which is, you know, kind of like the hallmark of science, is having your data and your results usable by future resources or researchers, they'll be forced to look at that through the theoretical lens that you recorded that site from. And I don't know. Maybe you can record it in a way that other people could interpret your results differently, and maybe it wouldn't cloud your judgment. I don't really know. But my efforts are to try to record things in a way that I'm not putting a massive bias on it. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm probably doing that by naming a projectile point, but that can easily be taken away. So, Doug, I think you were the first one in the comments here to disagree with that. What's up?
Yeah. So actually, I should probably ask your clarification. So when you're saying atheoretical, are you thinking along the lines of, like, you would just say, so to get more theoretical, to go to your example of a projectile point, you would just say, we found a lithic and it was this long and this wide and blah, blah, blah. And you think of theory in that sense as naming it like a, I don't know, Clovis point or something like that. Is that your idea of theory, or?
No, not really. Not really. I was just using that as an example of putting some bias in there, because I know, you know, I've worked with a lot of people, including in this last 6 months, where we found hundreds of projectile points, and they instantly try to look through resources and give this thing a name and jam it into a box, when in all reality, it might be something unique. It might be something that doesn't fit the, you know, the typologies of the area or something like that. And by jamming it into a quote unquote box and giving it a name, you're putting that bias right on top of it. And I hate it when people do that. And I would rather just take pictures of it, describe it, and let other people decide what they think it might be, you know, because my job is description when I'm standing there in the field.
So when I think of going atheoretical, though, I think this sort of a wider range in that, That I would say is more of a method, mm-hmm. and then theory. So in theory would be like, what do you decide to record? So I think a lot of stuff is when we decide to record sites, theory goes in, we record lithics. Okay, sorry, when I say we, I'm assuming most of us work in the, you know, or have worked in the American Southwest, and so, you know, it's Native Americans. But let's just use that as an example. But
right.
You know, you're talking lithics, all sorts of stuff like that. But, you know, when you're, that's not really a theoretical, that's heavily theoretical when we're deciding what we record. Because, mm-hmm. you know, we're not recording stuff like soil samples. Like, very rarely until you go to excavation does anyone record, oh, by the way, the site is sandy, stuff like that, when that might actually be valuable information. I think what I would think about with theory of recording and how we do data collecting, well, I think you're describing, you know, a sense of, you know, how you record a projectile point, I think you're thinking more methods. Well, I'm thinking theory of recording, theory of data collecting is deciding what we actually record, not how we do it, but like in a sense, you know, especially when it comes to like historical sites, that's huge. I shouldn't speak for everyone, but I find a huge problem in American archaeology with recording historical sites, because basically it just says, you know, you record cans and bottles and stuff like that, and you get marks so you can sort of tell ages and stuff. But there's a lot of stuff we leave off when we record historical stuff because we just, to be honest, it's looked down upon. I think of that as in theory and data recording is what we choose to record, not necessarily, you know, putting a name to a projectile point. I'd say that's more the method of recording.
Well, I don't disagree with you, and it might be just down to a terminology discussion, but sometimes those methods are grounded in theories because, the like we talked about at the beginning, that method is based on the agency requirements sometimes in how we do stuff, and those agency requirements are based in theory, which is what we talked about at the beginning of this show. So, but we'll pick this back up after a short break. Back in a second.
Thank you. Whether you're an undergraduate majoring in archaeology or a field tech that's wondering where to go next, the Go Dig a Hole podcast is for you. A new series on the Archaeology Podcast Network. Hosts Christopher and Andy answer a wide range of questions from those new to the field, with help from CRM, academic, and public sector archaeologists. This show is a companion to the blog GoDigAHole.com and tackles questions from readers and listeners to provide a toolkit aimed to help you get a leg up in the competitive field of archaeology. Subscribe to the show via the Archaeology Podcast Network, iTunes, or wherever you get podcasts.
Okay, we're back and we're going to wrap up this discussion. So we're going to end up talking about method and theory and applied theory and things like that as we wrap up this discussion. And to continue on with what I was saying before the break a little bit, you know, Doug, you were talking about theory in the field and I was talking about method and we were trying to have this discussion. But I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but method is created by theory. You first come up with a theoretical framework and then you figure out a way to apply that. So applied theory, which is another term for methods, right? This is why you don't typically have in the undergraduate level theory classes and method classes. You have a textbook called Archaeology, Method, and Theory, right? I mean, it's all usually kind of just rolled into one thing because the method is the application of the theory. So when we're talking about how we're recording a projectile point or how we're recording, you know, a site and what's defining a site, those methods are rooted in some sort of theory, right? So there is some sort of bias being applied at that level. And one thing that was mentioned in the comments a while back that we didn't talk about yet was, for example, why do archaeologists dig square holes? Well, I'll tell you what, the reason we dig square holes is because science. It's way easier to record the data, which is what we're doing. We're data collectors when we're digging square holes. We have to, it's easier from a numbers standpoint to dig a square hole and record that than it is to dig a round hole and try to figure out volume and all that stuff. Whether or not those things actually mean anything in the future, but it is not really the question. And this is why we dig like round shovel tests sometimes, is because we're more looking at this pinpoint in the slice of the landscape rather than a big thing. But when we go to do a full-scale excavation, we want to know exactly where each artifact came from, because quite honestly, we don't know if that means anything at the time. We hope it means something later on that we record 3 points, 3D position in space for this one artifact. But hey, maybe it doesn't. Who knows? But it might in the future. So I think you can't have a discussion of methods without talking about the theory that underlies those methods. But anyway, you know, one thing we were also talking about at the break was teaching theory and how it goes straight to the high level. And Bill, I think you had some good thoughts on that. You want to talk about that, because you're currently in the midst of a PhD program, which are usually heavily laden with theory anyway.
Yeah, because I'm perennially a 20-year-old that can never stop going to college, it doesn't seem like. It's like I spent all this time in college, but then I've been in here for 3 years and I've like forgotten the fact that for more than 10 years I wasn't in college. So it's like I degenerated. I think maybe like a bachelor on a bachelor party, you go back to your 20-somethings. Right. So the minute you enroll in college again, wow, you're right back to the same level you were. No, it's not that bad. But I was mentioning that I've taken a lot of these. As an undergrad, I actually did have a history of anthropological thought and archaeology, method, and theory. And then as a graduate student, because my undergrad classes could not possibly be sufficient enough, I had to take the same group of anthro theory and archaeology theory. And then once again, as a PhD student, they made me take that again. And those are their core courses for every graduate and undergraduate school that I've gone to. And they don't ever accept anyone else's, because magically rereading, you know, Lewis Morgan, his like 200 or however many year old articles is somehow different if you take it at a different university. But at any rate, after all six of those anthro and archaeology, method, and theory classes, there's like two that have ever been worth the salt. And they were the ones where you just read the articles 1 week And then they chose discussion leaders, and the people who were in charge of the discussion, they made maybe 5 or 6 questions that we were going to talk about, or topics or something like that. And then they just introduced those things one by one, and we just rolled with it. And when the discussion died down, if it ever did, we just went to the next question. And from those classes, I learned, you know, a lot more about anthro theory and archaeology theory. And I can tell you the very worst way you possibly can teach it is to have people read those same exact articles. Because remember, for like 100 years, none of the scholars that we all pay homage to have changed at all. So their articles that they've written are still the same exact article. It's just the different group of people you're discussing them with. That's the only thing that changes. The worst way to teach it is to have people read the same exact Binford article and then create a PowerPoint trying to guide everybody's thought through it and then tell them what to think in the class without any kind of discussion. And then that's the end of it, and give someone a test on what was, you know, in those articles. Within about 5 minutes of the PowerPoint screen coming on, I'm basically zoned out, dead. You know, you need to get the defibrillator to get me back alive. Those other classes where it's just discussion and you talk about the articles, I was awake the whole time. I was actually actively participating, and I learned. So you're right. The way that it's taught in school, your professor can destroy your interest or concern for theory by making one of these generic, by trying to control the dialogue too much. They can actually promote growth and a continued interest in theory and method if they do not do that, if they let you use your own mind.
So what do you think about some of these new and some of the older ones like Sonoma State and some of the other ones, some of these CRM-based master's degree programs? I mean, I took what was called a CRM master's program, but really it was taught by a bunch of academics, and it was taught more like a regular thesis, you know, like a regular degree program, and not really from a CRM focus. But I'm wondering if some of these real CRM focused programs with CRM instructors are teaching theory and in the context of the methods they're using in the field. You know what I mean? Like when they say we record a site this way, we say this and this and this about a site, that's based on this and this theory. And kind of, I would rather work backwards like that rather than say, hey, here's all these high level theories with their French quotes, and this is what it means after that, after they've already lost you, after your brain's already atrophied and you're just sitting there, you know, looking on Facebook on your phone, they totally lost you. You know what I mean? Or you're writing your next blog post, right, Bill? You don't do that in class.
No, not actually in class. I'm so old school. I still use paper and a notebook, and everybody looks at me like, what are you doing, freak? Like, why aren't you using your brand new Surface? You know, because a freaking Surface is not the same as a notebook. That's why. And I'm like so old, I can't type my notes. I have to write them with pencil.
Right.
Yeah, I don't really know what to say about those. I think that, well, if you focused so purely on the actual application or, you know, doing stuff in the field that you didn't have, just like, you know, when you first start doing CRM, if you focus so much on like doing the job, you don't really have time to talk about any of this like French philosopher stuff or any of this higher level theory. So I don't know if it's a disservice or not. I'm pretty sure, well, I mean, I'm very confident that people who take those technical degrees or whatever will end up using theoretical concepts, whether they actually in fact know that they're doing that or not, because the whole, like I was saying before, what we do as a craft is rooted in a certain kind of theoretical perspective. So in order to do good cultural resources and make quality recommendations or something like that, you would have to use those theories, even though you're actually unaware that you're using those. But I don't know. I mean, there is a value of learning those high-level French philosophers, not too much, but just as much as you can handle, because it gives you some kind of food for thought, and it actually does make you aware that you're part of a long lineage of archaeologists and anthropologists that have written, and thoughts have changed over time. That awareness, you know, kind of, if you actually paid attention and were thinking about what you're doing as opposed to, you know, just digging holes, you know, that kind of awareness can really help you later on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I took traditional school, so I really don't know anything different than, like, you know, year one, we're just going to learn about anthro theory and archaeology theory. Okay, year two, now you're going to learn all the stuff you wanted to learn. So,
right.
yeah, it's kind of force-fed to you when you go to a traditional school. And if you went to a CRM program like you're discussing, I don't really know any other way. So I don't know. You guys didn't just stand out there in, you know, where did you go? Georgia, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you didn't like stand there out in the grass and talk about, you know, Levi Strauss while ticks are devouring you, did you, or something? I mean, it was more like, come on, let's get this work done so we can get to the bar, and then maybe we'll talk about Levi Strauss if you're not too tired.
Right, right. Yeah, pretty much. Doug, go ahead.
I think I'm going to pick up on Bill's comment about how we talk about it, but we don't really. I think, and this might be just my personal experience, but pretty much on every sort of CRM, commercial archaeology excavation project I've ever been on, if we find something, we tend to talk about theory. We just don't put it in that terms of theory. So anytime you're excavating, I know, you know, you're going through and you start to find a feature. And basically, and this is my, so this might be my personal experience, and you guys please jump in and tell me if it's the same, is you then start talking about, oh, what could this possibly be? And it seems like, you know, throughout an entire day, you make 10 different guesses of what you're finding. And as you uncover more, your story changes. But that's how I've kind of worked through CRM, is most of the time is we're making up stories as we excavate until we finally get to a final story. And that story is not really a story. It's theory. It's why people are here. What are we finding? What do we think it is? What do we think it means? And even the most, you know, hardcore diggers who are like, I don't deal with that theory bullshit, will be there making up, I shouldn't say making up, hypothesizing about what we're finding, what it means, what's going on, and stuff like that. So I actually kind of think that more people in archaeology do theory, they just don't know that they're doing it. And it's because, as you say, they ended up going to a class where the first thing they do is throw some French philosopher at them and just, you know, they looked at it and were like, okay, well, I see the word the. And I think that's A, but that might be part of a French word, not 100% sure. And they pretty much shut down and don't ever really engage with what's being talked about. But most of the time, we're telling stories, and stories are theories of what happened and why it happened.
Doug, you're absolutely right. Sorry about this. It's called applied theory. That's kind of what I've called it. We've got those French philosophers that we all learn about in our undergraduate classes, where everyone is just sitting in class drooling because they're just so tired and just want to go have lunch or go to the bar, whichever. But, you know, I went into an applied archaeology program in New Mexico. It was fantastic. The degree that I have is in anthropology and applied archaeology. And what I enjoyed so much about that class, program, is that other than the fact that we did have one theory class that made you want to just fall asleep, as we developed through that program, we started taking very specific courses: Southwestern archaeology, Great Basin archaeology, Southeastern archaeology. And in each one of those, we had theory integrated throughout, and we were able to talk and discuss ideas. And we started using what I like to call applied theory. Theories change as we kind of learn more and we get out and we do work. And our application methods also change. So the way that we approach archaeology the next time also changes. We usually sit down after a project done and say, what were the lessons that we just learned? What would we do differently on the next project? Why would we do that differently? That's all part of theory.
Nice. That sounds like a really good program. And in our last few minutes here, I want to ask a question and see what you guys' thoughts on it are, because it kind of all comes down to this a little bit when we're talking about specifically CRM archaeology and being in the field and what we're doing out there. Is it important? You know, Doug, you mentioned how no matter what we're doing out there, whether we're conscious of it or not, we're using some sort of underlying theory to do what we're doing. I agree with that. That's true. The question is it important to be aware of that theory? Is it important to be aware of the theory that you're using to define XYZ or define a site or record a site or what your elements you're recording on that site? would it cloud your judgment or bias you unconsciously to a different conclusion or data collection method if you were conscious of that theory and the constructs of that theory? Would you think differently about it, even though you think you're not thinking differently about it? I don't know. Steven, you commented first on here. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm going to go with no with an asterisk. Mm-hmm. At a certain level, someone has to lay out what the methods are going to be for the project. And you are going to base that based off of past successes and failures and stuff like that. And for most of us, if you're not the person, being the PI or whomever, it doesn't matter. It's like, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to dig square holes? I'll dig you square holes. You want me to, you know, count the rocks in a certain way? I'll count the rocks in a certain way. How are we defining, how does this firm define a secondary flake? Okay. You know, I'll go with your definition. At a base level of like field tech, maybe a crew chief, probably a supervisor, you know, like depending on who's setting the standards for the methods, You might not need to think about it. You know, you have a job to do and it's a very mechanical job. The problem is, I think, that a lot of people, because that's what they're used to, they fail to see the theory about. So when it is their turn, when they've moved up the ladder and it's their turn to develop the methods, they just go with the rote.
Right.
At which point, you know, they are atheoretical in a bad sense, in that they're not necessarily being properly responding to the situation at hand, to the types of data, to the type of site. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, we always talk about CRM reports are mostly descriptive, but there is some interpretation there. And if you're not aware of like the theoretical underpinnings, then you might not be pushing that interpretation where it ought to go.
Right. Bill.
I would say it depends on how wedded you are to the theoretical construct, because I've worked on sites before where they're, you know, really interested in a historical period and you know, they're looking for this certain kind of a site or that's associated with these certain kind of ethnic or racial people. And they're basically blowing off like everything else. All the Native American stuff is getting short shrift. All the other stuff from somewhere else, you know, is getting short shrift, so that they can focus on this one time period because that's the one they've identified as significant. It actually happens a lot here in the Southwest where maybe Hohokam period stuff is not necessarily considered as important as the middle archaic or early late archaic stuff that they're going for, that's of course below the Hohokam. So they're like sampling the Hohokam stuff so that they can take a backhoe and rip down to the early agricultural stuff, because that's what gets you on CNN. Mm-hmm. And so, if your entire theory is based on, well, I want to know about behavior, but I only really want to know about the behavior from the certain time period, because I have these ideas about trade networks and developing agriculture or I have these ideas about race and class and ethnicity, and then all this other stuff about Native Americans where, you know, we can't actually figure out their race and class and all that stuff, we're just going to blow it off. If you're too wedded to a certain kind of theoretical construct, it can do major damage to a project.
Exactly. Doug?
I would just say that I think actually all archaeologists deal with theory. And I break down theory to the very basic term, which is an explanation of what's going on. That's basically story making. It's trying to explain what's going on. I think all archaeologists engage with that in some way. I know very few archaeologists who can simply turn off their minds when they're on a site and not think about what they're digging, why they're what's happening, what's going on, what they're finding, what's it mean. Maybe there might be a couple of people out there who can do that, but I think we all do it. I think possibly the issue is vast majority, as Stephen was saying, you know, maybe, you know, techs and field chiefs, well, they might think something, they might have theory in their minds, but they never actually get to put that into practice or put that into writing, because, you know, there's, when you write a report, there's only one story that goes out, and that's the company's story, not necessarily the multiple different theories that are going on. So mm-hmm. I think everyone, I end with everyone's always doing theory, It's whether other people get to hear that theory or not that I think matters.
Nice. Sonia?
All I can summarize by saying is, yes, we found everything that we do in some sort of theoretical framework, within that framework. The important thing to remember, at least for me, is that theory changes. Things change based on what you observe in the field. And it's okay if your data doesn't fit into a specific theory. I mean, that's important, because then it forces you to think outside the box mm-hmm. and change. And change is good, even though yep. we don't like it. So
Nice. All right. Well, that's a good place to end this on. If you're listening to this podcast and are just crazy over what we've been saying, leave some comments in the show notes for this, and or wherever you saw it, probably on Facebook. People like to rant on Facebook just when they see the title of the podcast, but I encourage you to, you know, listen to all these too. So if you're hearing this, though, you listened all the way through to the end, and that's good. And we'd love to hear your thoughts. Email us, and maybe we'll this is definitely a topic we could talk about over and over and over and over again, probably. So email us and maybe we'll talk about some of the listener comments. So all right, that's it for this show, and talk about some theory with your friends if you really want to bore them and lose them entirely. All right. That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for the episode. You can also email me at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or tweet your questions with the hashtag CRM Arc Podcast, or you can tag @arcpodnet in your tweet. Please share the link to the show wherever you saw it. If you share CRM archaeology related items on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere else for that matter, be sure to use the hashtag CRMArc so the community can see and comment. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and leave a review of the show. It helps us get noticed so more people can find our podcast and benefit from the content. Also, send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Also, please consider donating to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Your donations help fund our bandwidth and contribute to our editing costs. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Bye. Take care.
Bye-bye.
She stepped on you, Doug.
Has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Hey, we got it. We know how to do it. Let's just start over. We can talk and talk.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.